Hey there, are you looking for more of a multidisciplinary approach to pediatric therapy? Whether you are a clinician or a parent or just a community partner interested in pediatric therapy, this podcast is for you. We examine a variety of topics, looking at it from all angles. On this podcast, we'll have a panel of 2 to 3 participants talking about a variety of topics that we get from our Facebook group. So we have 2 different Facebook groups that you can join. One is specifically for clinicians only, and that's called the Peds Therapy Collective. The other group is more of a parent empowerment group. We're looking to help encourage and empower parents to understand that they have everything they need within them right now to help their child. And just for a little bit of support, we have our clinicians there in the group to help give guidance and point you in the right direction, get you down that right path to feeling successful with working with your child in whatever therapy they need, whether it's speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, maybe they're seeing a vision therapist, maybe they're working with an ABA therapist. Wherever you are right now, maybe your child is dealing with dyslexia, autism, ADHD, we really want to support you because our pediatric therapists have many specialties, and we're here to help kind of bring everybody's knowledge together and offer that to you, and also offer it to our clinicians so that we can better educate ourselves and really grow as professionals. So sit back and listen to our episode. On today's episode of the Peds Therapy Collective, I am speaking with 2 of my new colleagues, Vincent Letty, a physical therapist, and Carol Blueweiss, also a physical therapist. And the 3 of us are members of Mindy Silva's Wired On Collective. If you have not yet heard of Mindy Silva, please check out her podcast, Wired On Development. She really has been an inspiration for me. And if Mindy is listening, this podcast is dedicated to you and all of the work you do bringing clinicians across the world together. The point of this podcast is to collaborate as a trio of like-minded physical therapists, and our mission in a boot camp that we are participating in the Wired On Collective, is to learn more about one another. So please join us in discussing our topic of the importance of breathing. And I would like to introduce to you the group named Wired to Breathe. Well, I'm so excited to talk to you guys today. It was been really great to get to meet the 2 of you in our Wired On Collective group. And so I wanted to have some time today to get to know you a little bit more, and maybe just introduce our group. In our treasure hunt activity, we called ourselves Wired to Breathe. And I wanted to have this conversation today to introduce each other, but also to kind of talk about the main topic of breathing and the importance of breath, not only for the kids that we work with, but, you know, just being able to get the most out of every day. So I think I'll go ahead and ask Vincent to introduce himself here to the group.
Hi, my name is Vincent Letty. I'm a physical therapist. I work in San Francisco, and my background is in pediatrics. I've also worked in adults. I worked in the 90s, outpatient adult ortho and rehab. Started with NDT training, finished my adult NDT training, and then went into pediatric NDT training. And a long story short, ended up working the last 2 years with Mary Massery, Dr. Mary Massery, who teaches about breathing and postural control.
Wonderful. Well, welcome, Vincent, to our episode here today. And Carol, please introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Carol Blueweiss. I'm a physical therapist for over 20 years. Most of my career has been working with adults, but my entire career I've been working with children as much as possible, because that's always been what I love and what I've wanted to do. And as a clinical, one of my clinical education experiences was at Mountainside Hospital, where I was working in the rehab unit there with early intervention kids in rehab and head trauma. And so I have a lot of experience because it was a teaching hospital where I did a lot of rotations. And then I went into private practice for myself, working mostly with older people in the homes. I have a yoga certification, about 300, 400 hours. I'm still working to gain more hours. Right now I'm taking a certification with what's called physio yoga, which is a group of physical therapists who are yogis who are combining the ideas of yoga with physical therapy, teaching both yoga teachers and physical therapists and how to make them both work for rehab. I'm also a Feldenkrais practitioner. I wanted to learn more about the mind-body way of looking at things. Didn't want to be more of that automechanic kind of physical therapist that I mostly learned to be in the 1990s when I graduated. So I became a Feldenkrais practitioner and tried to work using that. And when I realized that I had a big gap in terms of working with children, I decided to join Anat Banyal's training, where I ended up actually redoing the Feldenkrais training her way, in her method, which is very similar but different. And then she has a specification for children. And that is what I try to work with now mostly. It's really works with older people too, and professionals, healthy people, but very powerful with children. And that is where I'm coming from in this collective that I've found myself in after listening to Mindy's podcast, because I'm also a podcaster and I am working on, I actually have a podcast right now interviewing parents of children with special needs, because I met so many great parents with so much knowledge in my Anat Banyal training. So that brings me to today and meeting Christine and Vincent.
Wonderful, Carol. That is great. So this is super, because I'm learning so much about the two of you, and I feel like we're all three of us collectors of knowledge. I've also been a therapist. This is my 19th year as a physical therapist. And I also started in adults, found my way to peds over the past 10 years. And I just really have kind of along the way kind of eclectically picked up all of these things. And, you know, I am working now in my core specialist training for MNRI with Svetlana Masakova. And so that kind of, you know, talking about the things that Mary Mastery speaks about, but also what Anat Banyal and Feldenkrais, I mean, it all comes together. So, you know, I think it's really cool, our three kind of viewpoints, but they all kind of Venn diagram over. And then with our yoga, I'm currently finishing up my 200 hour yoga teacher training. So that's been really great. And just kind of intuitively, I've always used breath as, you know, if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. So that kind of idea, and just being really curious about, boy, why do you hold your breath? Or why is breathing hard for you right now? Or how does that affect our postural control? And how is that affecting our tone? So it all unifies together. And that's why I really do like yoga as a starting point, because my gosh, thousands and thousands of years ago, they understood these concepts, and it's no different today. And just really grateful to be able to hook up together with you guys in this collective. We are part of the Wired On Collective with Mindy Silva. And, you know, she also has that podcast that you spoke about, Carol. And one of the first episodes I listened to of Mindy was an interview with Mary Mastery. And so that she got me hooked there, just thinking about that and really the importance of stepping outside of what we know or what we learn in school and being able to fill in that knowledge gap, because you leave school with, yeah, not enough, not enough information there. So I guess now we can just kind of move into, Vincent, I'm really curious about Mary Mastery's point of view and what you have been learning from her and what you're teaching now about breath.
So I did a 2-year invited mentorship to become a faculty member with Mary Mastery. And so there's too much to share in a 30-minute podcast where we're meeting each other. But I think the one thing that jumped in the front of my mind is that there is no normal way to breathe. And so everybody breathes very specifically to their own habits, to their own activities, to their own history of what they've done in their past and how their body works. And so if you're saying you're breathing the wrong way, you should rethink it and say, is your breathing an asset for you, for what you're trying to do, or is it something that's really hindering you or limiting you? And so I like looking at breathing in myself and in my patients to see, is that breathing a benefit for them, or is it holding them back? Because the muscles you use to breathe are the same muscles you use to move and to function. So your postural control and your breathing is completely intertwined.
That's great and so important, because I think that as a physical therapist, or even if you're someone who practices yoga or any sort of breath work at all, you might have this misconception that there is a right way to breathe, or you're not breathing how the instructor is doing that. Why do I breathe this way? So just kind of coming to an understanding that the best way for you to breathe is the one that helps you, and that might be different than somebody else. So that's a really great takeaway and summary of what you learned in those 2 years of that mentorship. Carol, how about for you? What do you see the link? What is the link between breathing and movement for you?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, really, Christine, because that's exactly where I wanted to take off from what Vincent said. First of all, I admire Mary Mastery very much. I've taken some of her courses, and I want to continue to learn from her. Part of her brilliance comes from her ability to integrate the body and not just take the body as separate parts. And I think that's where the Feldenkrais way of looking at things also overlaps with that. And it's hard to, so I've taken so many different things. I've also taken yoga for children. I don't know where one thing starts and one thing ends. And it's I want to give everybody credit because it does come from somewhere. But I've become such a mix of, I take from different things. So to answer your question, I just want to put it out there that it's not just from one way. This is just sort of my interpretation of the question, of the answer. But from a Feldenkrais perspective, just like what Mary Mastery said, there's no one way to breathe, and everybody is different. And from a movement perspective, let's say there's a child in front of me, or an adult. And the idea first is just to watch and observe and see how this person is in general. Like, who is this person in front of me? And the breathing is often a huge clue to what might be going on neurologically and parasympathetically, sympathetically. It's a big, big clue. So I usually look at that as a way to kind of see what might be going on, but not just physically, but also psychologically. And I also ask myself, how am I breathing right now? It's very important that I'm aware of my own breathing. And so that's part of it, because it's my nervous system connecting with their nervous system. So before I even go to maybe touch them, I will self reflect and just kind of take in and notice my breathing and do, you know, obviously it's, we don't have enough time to go into that, but I think that's just very important to notice, so that when I do touch them, what I'm trying to do is make them aware of themselves. So I'm not necessarily moving them. I am bringing their attention to themselves. And I do that usually through touching more of a bone than a muscle. And I might touch the clavicle and talk about how that's the clavicle. This is the sternum. These are the ribs. And the intention is not to change their breathing. The intention is just to make them feel. And oftentimes what happens is change happens. So I'm being very specific with movement in terms of breathing, because that's the theme of our talk today. And I would have them in whatever position they are most comfortable. And again, I will not try to change them. I will just try to make them aware and notice what is moving and what's not moving. And I hope that answers the question. If not, you can follow up. It's hard to explain.
It is hard to explain because, well, one, breathing is so vital. It is part of that life force. So we can kind of circle back to yoga. I mean, it is not the life force, but it is a way that we can get a handle on that. And it is something that we can control, but at the same time, it is something very subcortical. So it kind of crosses this bridge of, it's a primal drive to breathe, to be alive, but yet we can have control over that breath. And then as we work with the children, particularly those who have neurological differences, that difference between that primal drive, the reflexive drive to breathe, and how we coordinate that with our movement, how we coordinate that with an awareness or a lack of awareness, then can be bridged if we can access some of that cognitive space. Yes, Carol, what would you like to say about that?
So building on that, what you just said, so the idea of, let's say, putting my hands on a child's vertebra in the back and putting the other hand in front. And I might have the intention or the very gentle suggestion of flexion. And I know from Mary and, you know, yoga, what kind of breathing might be optimal with flexion. But I'm not going to make that person do. But I know that the nervous system and the child is really smart, and they're going to gravitate. So I'm at least giving them the opportunity to kind of figure it out themselves so that their brain can change. So it's all very non-linear. And my hands are suggesting flexion. And then if I just change a little bit, very gently, very so super gently, the direction of my pressure in my hands, suggesting extension, then I might feel in my hands a different, whether it be an inhalation or an exhalation. Now, as a scientist person, I know what I would like to feel. We know what's the optimal in yoga. We give instructions. In physical therapy, we give instructions, trainers give instructions on when to breathe in and when to breathe out. But without using words, I would just use my hands. And so that's one way closer to understanding what I might do for someone in terms of movement and breathing and relating that to yoga.
Absolutely, Carol. And I think I'll have Vincent answer this next, but what I hear you saying is that you're creating safety. You're creating an environment to let the body do what it naturally does best. And so I'd be curious to hear what Vincent has to say to kind of add to that regarding breathing and movement.
Well, what I love about yoga as a practice is that all you're doing with your breath is you're learning with a good instructor, you're learning to move with your breath, which in Mary Massery's course, we call ventilatory strategies, or breathing in when your body is expanding your rib cage, breathing out when your body is starting to collapse your rib cage. And so part of that 200, 400 hours of learning, you're learning when you're cueing your clients, your patients, to breathe with movement. So I love that part. And when you start finding that the movements are really hard for you, and in yoga, you get into weird movements and strange poses, and it makes you really struggle to breathe on while you're in an inverted pose or in a very stretched pose. But it's not, it's the same for our children. So when our children move and they're hitting a movement that is hard for them, you can tell by their breathing, because they will either go to breath hold or they'll start shallow, quick breathing. And it tells you that your patient is now in a struggle to move while still breathing. And for you to just pay attention to that when they are in rest and when they're in comfort, and then continuing to watch them as they are starting to move, you will find the moments when the postural demands exceed what they can actually stabilize. And one choice that we have as humans is to hold our breath. So breath holding is a very often seen strategy in children and adults that have challenges moving, or in me, if I am in a yoga pose that is challenging for me, then I will go to breath holding. So being aware of those cues with your patients or with yourself tells you something about how well you're moving while breathing.
That's great, Vincent. Thank you for emphasizing that. And it kind of goes back to that wasn't necessarily a conscious choice to hold your breath. That just happened as a matter of protection or your attention is divided. I just recently learned how to do a headstand. And during that time, I sure as heck was not breathing like I am breathing right now. But the same may be true if you're under a lot of stress or resistance in an emotional situation. And that might be the case for some of the children that we work with autism, or anything, if they're uncomfortable with us in an interpersonal way, or if they're not feeling safe in the environment where we're working with them, we might see that same breath holding, not because it's physically demanding necessarily, but just that increased demand on any of their senses. I guess this question can be for either of you guys. When we start to notice that breath holding or that shallow breathing, and they're not necessarily responding to the things we would expect them to respond to, where do we go next?
Well, I hate to be, I don't know what there's a word for what it's going to sound like, but I need to be more specific. I need a, because the way I always look at everything is a case by case basis. So it's hard for me to answer that question.
Okay, I understand. But if somebody's not doing what you would anticipate with your hand on their ribs or their clavicle or their vertebrae, how do you, I say titrate, modulate, change your inputs to get more of what you're hoping to see?
Well, I'm going to put my Feldenkrais hat on, my ABM hat on, and that's where I do like to work with kids, and where I believe it can be effective with anything, and especially with breathing. I would not have an intention to try to change the child, which is very different than being a PT. The intention would be to feel what is the child. So first, it would be to notice whatever I notice. Like there's going to be a change somewhere. And I'm looking for that connection of where that child might need, maybe it's at the rib cage, they might need a little bit of support, maybe a little bit of an awareness more in each rib or maybe as a whole, the idea of going more into helping the child differentiate between their ribs and their chest and their abdomen, giving them that tactile information so that maybe they will figure out a different tactic to get to where they might be breathing more. But I don't know what is going to happen. I will just try to support somewhere else and see how that particular child responds. And I hope that answers the question. I don't mean to be elusive.
Yeah. No, that's like you said, you are basically experimenting. You want to, you're helping the child feel safe so that we all have the drive to be in homeostasis. We all have the drive to be successful and thriving. And if we're in this calm and alert state that you're creating by your drawing the awareness to the child, your hands are being placed in a loving, secure way. You're meeting them with the intention and your energy of calm and alert in yourself. We're aligning energy, not to sound too meta, but we are all balls of energy here. So I think that's a really great answer. And Vincent, what say you from your perspective?
So yeah, rephrasing the question. So what would I do if I see a breathing pattern that doesn't support the activity, which could be breath holding, which to me is kind of an outcome measure. If a child or an adult is breath holding in an activity, let's say going from supine to sideline or from supine to sit, that just tells me that it's still a task where they need to increase their postural stability by holding their breath, and it's hard for them. So there's weakness. I might cue them with my breath. So as they are starting a roll, if they are a flexion roller, I might cue them with an exhale, because an exhale and flexion go well together. Or if they're an extension roller, I might cue them with an inhale, because that inhale goes with an extension movement. Again, there is no good or bad between flexion or extension rolling, but it is something I observe as I'm going with my patient. And I will cue them and say, well, if I just let you hear my exhale with the roll, you typically tend to follow the person next to you who's breathing out or in. And that's also the same when I'm talking to a mom who has a really high frequency of breathing, high respiratory rate, chest breathing, anxious, talking about her patient. I feel my respiratory rate go up and I need to consciously use a lower voice and calm down my breathing to get my mom to do the same. So I model if my patient consciously or subconsciously follows that to get a better pairing to what I want to do, whether it's decreasing anxiety when somebody's chest breathing or if it's a functional movement and they're exhaling when they're trying to roll with flexion, which would be a mismatch of basically your physiological most paired activity in your breathing would be an exhale with flexion. So any activity that is a flexion activity where your chest is going into flexion, your spine is going into flexion, your rib cage is getting smaller, you should try to exhale instead of holding it. Does that help?
Yeah, I think that that's, you know, it's interesting that you talk about pairing those movements together. I personally do not feel comfortable in extension. I don't have a lot of postural control in extension. I would rather be here, and I don't have a lot of awareness, or prior to really focusing on yoga, my body would rather come to a flexed position. And so actually over the past year, I have found that I can feel safer in extension if I focus the exhale there that I can grow safety and extension there. So it's just interesting, like, but that's my perception of it. But I will also say that my nervous system is not the most smooth nervous system. So I suppose, like you said, there's no real right way to breathe, but I feel safety in exhaling with extension. That allows me to go there better than flexing and exhaling. So just, it's an interesting idea what it's maybe should be and what another person's perception of the stimulus is.
Yeah. And it's really, that's really, really interesting. That's, I have to say, a little unusual, and it would be interesting. There's so much there that could be explored, you know, with your movement and why that is that you feel comfortable in that sort of opposite physiological pattern. And I think Moshe Feldenkrais would say the optimal situation would be to give someone both scenarios and let them choose, because when you have a choice, you're most intelligent, and then you can actually know. The trick is to be aware of what you have chosen, not necessarily why, but just having that choice. And like Vincent started off by saying, there's no right or wrong. There is a, and this is a, maybe more of a philosophical conversation or not, but you know, there are very good reasons to think of exhalation on flexion and inhalation on extension because of our physiological way we were kind of made. But there are going to be times when that isn't probably optimal. And, you know, we just can't research every time someone does the opposite, but you know, it can be functional. People can do both. So it's more like if it's a therapeutic, if you're trying to get someone maybe to flex, you can use that breath to help them with that movement of flexion, like Vincent's logic. But it's interesting what you say, because that just exactly goes to show that everyone is different and you are a perfectly healthy person. And maybe you would learn something if you did it the other way. You might still prefer your way.
Correct. And I think when we think about these constructs that we place on ourselves or our patients of what is ideal or what we learn in school or in textbook, and the response that we get from our patient is a big no thank you, or I can't do that, or I don't even know what that means, then I think it is, we can know the physiological response that we would expect, but we have to start where the patient is at. And I know, Vincent, you would agree with that. So my immature nervous system, which I'll be perfectly straightforward, I have, is here today. And I can move forward to something more mature or more smooth or more fluid with practice. But if I'm forced into that today, and I am not ready for that, that doesn't feel good to me, then I'm going to just keep, resistance will always be met with resistance. So I think that's kind of where that yoga piece comes in, to be mindful of not only noticing our patient, but also our own responses. And how do we provide a good model? How do we bring ourselves back down to calm and alert so that we can get the best out of our patient or family that we're working with? And I think these are really great examples of how we do that. Vincent, anything else you'd like to add to this conversation?
What came up in my mind was that there is preferences, and everybody has their own preferences, and it's based on what you have done. So one of the examples we're using in the breathing course is that if you sit with more flexion, your breathing will be different than if you sit with a lot of extension. And you can even just model that for yourself. So if you're sitting up really straight, like you are a super confident person, and you look up, you tend to breathe more with your chest. And when you are sitting with your shoulders forward and your head down, and you're sitting more in flexion and your eyes are down, you tend to use more diaphragmatic breathing. So even your same body will breathe differently based on how you feel and how you posture yourself. So if you are a really tall girl in middle school and you're developing, you tend to make yourself smaller because you want to fit in. So you go down with your eye gaze, you speak softer, you keep your shoulders more forward to hide your breasts, and your breathing will be affected. You might be a posterior breathing, or you might be a diaphragmatic breather, where if you're very short and confident and perky, and you bounce off the mat as a gymnast or a cheerleader, the breathing pattern you choose will be matched with a lot more extension and with chest breathing. Again, the body is the same, but you can quickly make those choices based on the environment, based on how people treat you, based on how confident you are. But most of the time, those patterns are becoming wired. That's why we are calling ourselves wired to breathe. Neurons that fire together, wire together. And so that pattern that you've chosen as your favorite or customary breathing pattern is hardwired, and it takes time to change. And I think what you just told me is that through your yoga practice, your breathing pattern is changing and it's affecting your posture, which is really beautiful.
Yes, yes. And again, nothing that was necessarily conscious about that breathing, but as you start to experience different movement patterns and then you start to increase your coordination. I did want to go back to something you said, Vincent. You mentioned that there was some weakness. And I have a hard time about weakness because I don't see it as postural instability is due to weakness as much as poor coordination of the systems. So I don't, just curious on, there very well may be weakness, yes. But especially if we're looking at a baby, there's nothing to be weak from there, you know, so what is that? Or, you know, if you do something posturally with your hands, Carol, and you give them some stability, you didn't give them strength. When you, in gym class, if someone sits on your feet, that person who sat on your feet didn't give you strength. It gave you stability so that you can coordinate better. So I'd just be curious to hear your thought on that.
Carol, did you want to respond? Because you were raising your hand.
Yeah, I was raising my hand before that question, but I think this will morph into that answer. One thing very important to note too is what Vincent, on what you were saying about, I think it's a great example, the adolescents who depending on, and then you could have a combination, you could have a short person with low self-esteem and also bends down to, I just want to point that out. But so emotions play a part in how we breathe, how we feel, and which came first, the chicken or the egg? Do the emotions create this protective response, flexion, and then therefore our breathing changes to be more diaphragmatic or in our abdomen versus the other way around? So that's also a philosophical question, I believe. But what I feel is missing usually in conversations about this kind of stuff is that we are such complex human beings. We have a brain that melds everything together and all our systems work in conjunction with each other. And there's also this, well, there's the fascia is a great example of just everything is connected. The brain connects the nervous system, the endocrine system, the skin system, everything is connected. And so when Christine, you talk about weakness, I have the same kind of visceral response, like, it bothers me that we learn to say, because first of all, we don't know. It's an assumption. And we do a lot of our work on assumptions. And I think the best therapists and the best doctors are the people that say, this is what I think, but I don't know for sure, as opposed to saying, this is due to this, this is due to weakness. So I am very much biased towards the motor control way of looking at movement. And in that way of looking at it, it's more the nervous system driving the muscles and the movement. And it is not necessarily a strength issue. But as a result, there could be weakness. But I don't know that it even matters. Unfortunately, because of insurance, we have to say someone is weak, someone is strong. This is where they are weak, this is where they are strong. And I think that we are driven by that linear thinking, but our bodies are not linear. And that, again, becomes a philosophical conversation.
Great answer. I think that's the best answer. Vincent, would you like to add to that?
What I meant with weakness, I meant that in your can, like Dr. Massery calls it the can, all the muscles that contribute to the strength of that can, they extend from the vocal cords at the top, your top diaphragm, through your diaphragm in the middle, which is your breathing diaphragm, and your pelvic floor at the bottom, which is the lower diaphragm, and all the muscles connecting in between. If there is one of the muscle groups, and there's many of them, I think it is, I think 2/3 of your muscles in your body are contributing to your postural strength in your core. If any of them are either weak or not doing their task at the time that they should be doing it, you have a weakness of the can and you're not able to generate enough pressure to keep yourself up against gravity.
Yes, thank you. And Carol, I'll get to you. So you mentioned something really important, Vincent, that MNRI talks about a lot, timing. So timing is so important. It's not just about how much force you can create, but it's how quickly you can, how long you can sustain it. At the right timing, are we doing all these things? So so thanks for bringing that up. Carol, what did you want to add?
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to add that you know, I totally see that logic is very logical. But where then, Vincent, I wonder, you would say about, and maybe we just have to divide it up into healthy neurological systems versus people that have a process going on that makes the nervous system not work correctly. So maybe that's where we have to go with this question. So it's not meant to be a derogatory question, but you have a healthy teenager whose can is all not optimal, the pressure's all off because of their posture, which is not a conscious choice. And it's not a choice because probably they're weak, they're adolescents, they're healthy, but because emotionally, for the reasons you said. So there's that, that's an emotional trigger to be in that posture versus someone who is in those postures because of, you know, so is that, do you think the difference, Vincent, like if you're working with a child who has something's not working right in their body, and then you can start to think about that pressure system and the muscles and the all that versus someone who is healthy but is also in those positions, but for different reasons?
I think, Carol, that what I would say that both systems, a patient with orthopedic issues or neurologic issues or scars or emotional reasons, if their posture changes and the effect is that change leads to not optimally breathing for functioning or for postural control, that you have to find a problem. What is the problem? Is the problem in your skin and fascia? Is the problem in your musculoskeletal? Is it in your emotional realm? Is it in the neurological system? Is there a spinal cord injury, upper motor neuron issue? Is there a muscular reason that the muscles are not firing, like a muscular dystrophy? In all the different reasons that you can think of, you still need to either provide support for the pressure, passive support, or passive support for the positioning, whether that is in a wheelchair, giving passive positioning, or in a bed, passive positioning, to optimize the chance that you have to move and breathe at the same time. So it's a very wide question. And I think it's much easier to answer individual with more specific patients that you and I work with to say, well, where do you start? You always have to do the clinical reasoning. Where can I make the biggest difference as a physical therapist or an occupational therapist or a speech therapist to get to the function?
Well, that's so true. We'll wrap up here today, but I'm big on our senses. So I say that there are 10 sensory pathways, 5 internal, 5 external, and we're all sensory beings. So we're all taking information in from these internal, external senses all of the time. And if I am in a safe space, if I perceive safety, my functions are going to occur. If I don't perceive safety, and I'm not talking cognitively, I'm talking about just body perceived safety, I'm either going to shut down or fight or flight. And then the last would be this autonomic dysregulation, autonomic response for this faint or whatever is happening. So I think, you know, in my understanding, and as I learned through MNRI, and as I listened to the talk that we just listened to from Stuart Starcher through empathy and the roots, it is really about finding safety for our patients and for ourselves and optimizing that and taking it at our clients, our patients' pace, or the patient's family's pace, so that we all stay kind of guiding along together. Because I don't care who you are, if you're the best physical therapist in the world, if you don't have that child or the child's family meeting you there, you're not going anywhere. So I think it's really cool to have this conversation with three of you guys. Why don't we go ahead and close it up here though with Vincent, any last thoughts?
I just love the fact that these the wired to breathe put us together in one room to discuss breathing. And there's so much to think and say about it and to learn about it. The question I have for both of you to finish with is, can you talk about the practice of the sound of in yoga? Because I'm fascinated by glottal control. And it is my impression, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not a yoga teacher, I'm a yoga practitioner. I do yoga with my teacher. It's my impression that the sound of that you use in yoga is a way to practice breath support with vocal cord control, eccentric control of voice to benefit movement and health.
Carol?
Well, I think that is a great topic for our next podcast. I don't think I can for sure answer that off the cuff. I know that it's a great question, and I'd like to search for some answers to make those connections, because it is really interesting. You have this yoga philosophy that I believe should be our handbook in everything, in physical therapy and everything. This everything that so much of what is involved with yoga is related, I think, to what we do as physical therapists. And this is a great example. And I'm sure in my many, many books that I have, I will find, now that I would look for that specific kind of, you know, what I do know is their language in and of itself, Sanskrit language, is yoga is based on the language of Sanskrit and all their chanting. I mean, yoga has 8 limbs, right? So the asanas are just one. So where sound comes in, I'm not 100% sure, but it's certainly as important as anything else. And it involves the whole body. Whether they would scientifically say it's how Mary would explain it or how you, Vincent, would explain it, but it's a great question to see where there is a link and a connection, because sound vibration is so understood. And I think that since they do that in yoga, I'm gonna have an answer for you if we ever do this again.
Yeah, I think we definitely can dive into that. I think that primal sound, that ah and oom, and then the vibration, and then we can talk about the activation of our vagus nerve, how that's going to activate so many systems in our body, parasympathetic, kind of stop putting on that brake, and being able to, now we can tie that to our third eye chakra and understand that that is where intuition, knowledge, this integrating force that that we can use. So I think, you know, bringing it back to postural awareness and control, and how, what part of our body makes that sound. And often when I work with so many children who are nonverbal, they are making sounds here in this area as a form of self-regulation, as a form to create this pressure, this hydrostatic pressure for control, for movement. And I think, you know, we think of it so simply as just om, but it's so much deeper than that. And yeah.
Great. Yeah. Because I've talked to my yoga teacher about it. And also to the author who wrote the book about medical yoga for physical therapists. And there's so many layers to which can go to chakras. It can go to the Indian traditional healing. I just look at it as a great eccentric way to control pressure. And in my kids and patients, I find that the kids who have very poor oral motor control and voice control also have a lot of postural control issues. They don't hold themselves up that well if they cannot control the top valve, the top diaphragm. So that's my current obsession with the sound in yoga, because it's so beautiful.
Well, that's really great. And for everybody out there, we can even just begin with that V's breath breathing, if we're just going to hum, and just begin to get that vibration and feel what you feel like in your body. So if you were just to take a natural breath in and exhale, whatever vibration you feel comfortable doing, and you can play around with the different vibrations, what's right for you, and notice in your body where you are feeling that sensation, that vibration. You can notice about what emotions are coming up, and just let that be. You don't have to place any judgment on that. Just start to be aware of yourself and your breath. And is that easy for you? Is that hard? And that's how we unite all of this together. So thank you so much to the two of you for talking with me today. It was really great to have you on today. And we will definitely talk soon.
Thank you.